Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Good morning, Caffeinators. Dave, it's, coming up on 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning for me. How's it going down there, or out there for you?
It's pretty good out here. It's about noon here, so a little bit later in the day. It's starting to warm up. It's supposed to be around 60 today, so I'm hoping to get out and do a nice run out in the actual warm weather instead of the cold and rain that we've had here.
Yeah.
How are things going out there?
It's nice. It's, you know, same thing, kind of bright blue sky, and we actually have had a few days in the mid-80s this week. While I've been on my lunch break, I sat outside to soak up some sunshine and have my morning coffee outside. I have a cup of Highlander grog going from Door County, and it's so good. It looks like it's going to be another beautiful day, and my wife got her second coronavirus vaccine this week. Was good. She got the Moderna. She was pretty ill from it after I think maybe like 12 hours post injection. She was pretty ill for like maybe 18 hours or so, had a fever and chills and, you know, really bad headache and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, Robin got her first one on Thursday, and no sickness, just the sore arm and she was all proud that she got the Moderna, because that's the Dolly Parton one.
Yeah, that's the one Molly got as well. And the first shot was kind of the same for her, a little bit of a sore arm, but no other effects. So hopefully Robin won't have any of those effects with the second round. But yeah, it's good to see that, you know, a few of us are slowly but surely starting to get vaccinated. I see it more and more online, especially, you know, our colleagues and friends that have been able to get vaccinated or at least, you know, have appointments or what have you. So I don't know. It's a little ray of hope for me. And you're headed back up to Connecticut soon for another.
I am. I guess they really liked me. So I'm heading back up to Connecticut in a couple weeks. I think the 20th or the 21st, I'm heading up there. So going to spend another week up there and living in a hotel room. And I'm hoping that's not everything that this job is going to be for me. I'm not a huge fan of traveling. This time I'm going to do a little bit different. I always try to be the one that I don't like to check a bag, and I don't like to pick it up at the airport. I'd rather just have it with me. And this time I think I'm just going to check it, because that was one of the main problems of traveling, was having to carry around everything. I'd rather just have one little bag to carry around and be a princess, I guess.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. Whatever. Whatever works. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that going to be another opportunity for you. So.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think? Should we go ahead and get started with this episode? I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I am too. This is going to be a good one.
Yeah. So we have Ed Durham coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today, and you may have heard Ed's name either through like lecturing at IVEX or different conferences or seeing his name around. But he's the senior cardiology veterinary technician at Southwest Florida Veterinary Specialists in Bonita Springs, Florida. He began working in veterinary medicine in 1976 and first received licensing as a veterinary technician in 1986.
He's got to be the longest tenured.
Yeah. I would say so. He's been employed in both clinical and research positions, including nearly 5 years in open heart surgery, cardiopulmonary bypass, and total artificial heart research, which sounds just absolutely fascinating. Yeah. He's been in the research field some, and he's an LATG, laboratory animal technologist. Has worked at University of Missouri Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital for the cardiology service, and also more recently in the Caribbean island of St. Kitts and Nevis for Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine, and he's also the editor and co-author of the Cardiology for Veterinary Technicians and Nurses, which was published in 2017 by Wiley-Blackwell for those seeking VTS in cardiology, and that's a lot of what we're going to talk to him about today.
Yeah.
So, Ed, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. Thank you so much for coming by today. What can we get you for a cup of coffee?
Hey, well, thanks for having me. I'm not sure what you call it in this particular cafe. Some places call it a depth charge. Maybe it's a red eye for you, but whatever it is, it's a double shot of espresso and a cup of coffee, please.
All right.
Oh, wow.
All right. All right.
That's a lot of caffeine for someone who's focused on the heart, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Go big or go home.
Yeah, that's a great way to get a Saturday started.
Yeah.
So, Ed, we always have people start off by kind of taking us through their career path, and it sounds like you've had a lot of twists and turns along the way, done a lot of really, really cool things. So if you don't mind, just take a few minutes here and talk about what started you in veterinary medicine and started you down the cardiology path and some of the cool stops you've had along the way.
Well, I would have to say that what got me started in the veterinary medicine world, it was actually my mother married a veterinarian. And I didn't actually know this is what I wanted to do. I completely fell into it. But as a child, there were three things I really loved as a child. One was animals. And I mean, when I say animals, I mean wildlife, like the scary things on Mutual of Omaha. That was my thing. Like every Sunday, yeah. I'm in front of the TV watching Mutual of Omaha. Marlon Perkins was my hero. I knew I loved science. I was really geeked on science. And I knew I loved things of an acrobatic nature. So gymnastics, martial arts. And those are the three things that have really stayed with me. So anyway, my mother, after my parents divorced, my mother married a veterinarian. And when I was 14, I went to work in his clinic. And I actually remember it was May 7th, 1976.
Wow.
And I was the janitor. And that's really where I started. And now my joke is when, you know, I'm mopping the floor in the clinic, it's like, I'm just getting back to my roots. So, and I really just sort of blossomed into it from there. And in many ways, it was, I had nothing better to do. And my stepfather was a real dedicated clinician. And so, you know, Saturday mornings was like, you're coming to work with me. I worked in the evenings. And as I moved through high school, I started working a 11 or 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. shift. And then eventually started doing overnights as he opened an emergency clinic. And it just kind of grew from there. I wasn't entirely sure that this is what I wanted to do. And I put off getting my licensing certification as a technician till 1986, because I don't know that this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. But eventually I thought, well, you know, I'm in it. I'm pretty good at it. I seem to be doing it. I should go ahead and get licensed. And my path of licensing is probably no one can do anymore. You probably don't have very many people who did it. So oddly enough, I never went to tech school. I never taken the VTNE. So back in the 80s, there was only, say, 15, maybe 20. I think it was just 15, if my research memory is good, accredited tech schools in the entire nation. And so at that time, states were desperate for credentialed technicians who knew some stuff. And I was living in Arizona. And so I took the Arizona state examination, which allowed me to get my first license as a veterinary technician. Interestingly enough, my stepfather was the head of the technician education committee, and my certificate of passing the exam and getting my licensing has his signature on it. It's just something I'm quite excited about. And believe me, he did not pave the pathway.
If anything, right.
This was the guy who put the obstacle in front of you just to make sure you really earned it.
Yeah.
But it was a comprehensive exam at that time. And I'm not even sure the VTNE existed, to be
fair. Yeah, I was going to say, when did that start? I don't know exactly.
I want to say VTNE that start. Actually, I have it written down somewhere, but I'm pretty sure it started in the early 90s.
Okay.
Or maybe late 80s, but I'm not 100% sure it was there in 1986. And so, you know, so that's kind of how I got into the field. And actually, at the time, I was no longer working in his clinic. At that point, I had moved to my research position where I was doing the cardiopulmonary bypass and open heart surgery, which is something that he helped me get into. He knew the doctors that were there, and I had done a short stint in a pharmacy. But then I went to work for this research lab that was housed in a human hospital. And so I was technically a human hospital employee. I was the research technician for this in vivo research lab, and all the the hospital was known for its cardiovascular medicine, and we had several different doctors who were in doing all sorts of research. And, you know, if you talk to anybody who's now, they use what's known as these fiber oxygenators. Well, I remember back in the day when they were open canister bubble oxygenators, and you could easily pump air to the patient. And it was,
wow.
So I was really on the cutting edge of that sealed system. So I got to do open heart surgery. We started an artificial heart program. There was all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, getting to put patients on bypass was very, very cool. This is my probably my funnest story. Funnest, is that a word? So there was a Chinese dentist who had come to work at the hospital with us to develop an artificial heart. So he had an idea for a heart. And at the time, this was when the Jarvik 7 that was all over the news was the big thing. And so the problem with the Jarvik 7, and most people don't know this unless you're into this field, is that it's huge. And the reason Barney Clark was able to have the Jarvik 7 put in him is he was a very tall, big person with a very broad chest.
Okay.
And if he had been a 150-pound woman, there's no way he would not have gotten the heart. And so this dentist had come up with a new design that was a smaller profile, but yet said had the same cardiac output features. And so we were developing this heart, and we actually had an implant scheduled for, I believe it was a Monday morning, or maybe it was a Wednesday morning or something. And it got canceled because the surgeon had to be doing emergency surgery that morning, the guy who was in charge of the program. And so we're like, okay, well, we're not going to do it. I came into work at 8 o'clock, and all the other members of the team were tearing my lab apart. I mean, you know, imagine people opening cabinets and throwing stuff out behind them onto the floor. Wow. And I walked in, and they all turned around almost simultaneously and said, "Ed, where's the heart?" So I went over to the cabinet and got it out. So it happened to be sterile and ready to go. And as it turned out, a gentleman in Tucson, Arizona. I was living in Phoenix at the time. And the gentleman in Tucson had had a heart transplant. He rejected the heart immediately on the table. The surgeons there in Tucson tried to get a Jarvik heart for him because there was no other natural hearts around. Jarvik said, "We don't have one." And in desperation, they called us. We happened to have a heart. So our team, like not me, but everyone else, the perfusionist and the surgeon, jumps on a helicopter, flies down to Tucson, and puts this non-FDA approved experiment heart in this man. And they kept him alive for, I want to say, like 12 or 14 hours until they could actually get another donor heart for him. And he actually improved. His condition improved on our heart. Unfortunately, we did get our hands slapped by the FDA, and they kind of said, "Don't ever do that again."
Right.
But yes. Yeah, so
but also great work.
Yeah. I was part of the infamous Phoenix heart fiasco of the 1980s.
So, okay.
And then, you know, after they closed that facility due to funding after about 5 years, and then I moved to California. I did some clinical practice there. And then ultimately I wanted to re-educate myself a little bit more on it. So I found a position at the University of Missouri, which was actually still a research position. It was doing research in osteoporosis, which is where I had a great time working with pigs. So that was a lot of fun. And then ultimately I moved over to the vet school, where I got to work with Dr. John Bonagura, who is, you know, considered one of the greatest gurus in veterinary cardiology since Patterson, Detweiler, and Buchanan. I mean, he's, you know, considered one of the top people in the world. And to be able to work with him was amazing. And from him, what I really learned was, I call it the mystery of internal medicine, because all my cardiac experience of that had been surgical. And I wanted to grow up to be Chris Orton at Colorado State doing all this surgery. And, you know, but I didn't, you know, that wasn't a path. So I went to work with Dr. Bonagura and got into the internal medicine aspect. And it just completely absorbed my life. And after working with him for probably 2 years or so, I thought, you know, the doctors can specialize. Why can't technicians specialize? And so it was under my time at University of Missouri that I started looking into specialization. And frankly, I didn't even know that the Emergency and Critical Care Academy existed. Mm-hmm. And as I started to dig in, is when I found out, oh, okay, there's a framework for this. This has already been laid out. That makes this a whole lot easier. And then I got connected with Linda Merrill at Academy of Internal Medicine for Veterinary Technicians, or as we like to call it, AIMVT, because we're aiming high. Thank you very much.
Nice.
Yeah. And then she kind of laid out what their plan was, that so the Internal Medicine Academy is different from all the other academies in that we have subspecialties within the internal medicine umbrella.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. And so I took over heading up the cardiology portion of it, and you know, did all the organizing committee things that the Directorate Large of Cardiology does, writing the exam, coming up with the skills list, the knowledge list. You know, I headed up the group of 7 technicians who did that. And then from there, after, you know, we got our exams going and we all got our VTSs, and now we have like 22 or 23 VTSs in cardiology.
Really? There's only 22 or 23?
Just in cardiology. Now, the internal medicine is much larger.
Oh, but sure. Yes,
cardiology itself, we're in the mid to low 20s.
Wow. That's awesome. I worked with one while I was at Tufts University the last few years. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I've worked with one as well.
Was that Barb or was that
Kristen Antoon?
Kristen, yeah. I remember Barb Brewer. I don't know if you know Barb Brewer. She was the technician at Tufts before Kristen came in.
Ah, okay.
And
no,
she was my second. She was the one that I actually got to know her through John Rush, and we're like, hey, let's form this thing. And then we realized that the internal medicine group was already doing it, and they had no one from cardiology. So when Barb and I showed up, they were thrilled. Like, gotcha. Oh my gosh, someone to do cardio. This is amazing.
Yeah, I think she must have already been gone by the time I got there. Yeah. Because Kristen was already in that role. Yeah.
Yeah, she retired, I'm going to say 2010 or 2012. Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bless her heart. She has amazing tech. Love her to death. So I had worked at the University of Missouri for 18 years. The VTS was off and running. We were holding exams every year. People were getting their credentialing. And as cardio techs, I was super excited. Our service had grown. We went through a period where I had 0 cardiologists, and then we were up to 2 and 2 residents, and I wasn't doing as much hands-on work. And I became a little bit bored with what I was doing. And I've been doing lectures for technicians at these conferences about the career. And I'm a real big self-motivation guy. Like, I'm always wanting to be a better version of myself. And I was standing in front of this group of techs. I'm giving them this big spiel about, you know, you should always push your boundaries and do things you've never done before. And I got off and I was like, man, you are not even listening to your own advice. So I started looking at other opportunities, and a position came open at Ross University in their anesthesia department. And the way Ross handles their courses, they do these very condensed 15-week semesters, and you do semesters back to back for 3 years, and then you go off to a U.S. school and finish out your fourth year. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they actually still do live animal anesthesia. Their students do recovery surgery. And so there's, you know, they get practical use of doing island pets, doing spays and neuters, and like real veterinary work. And the technicians are the ones who run these labs. And so I thought, great, anesthesia, something I know a little about, but it's been 20 years since I've done it. So obviously things have changed.
Right.
My cardiology is useful to anesthesia. So I brought something, but I gained something, and I knew I liked to teach. And so it was a match made in heaven. I got to live on the island. I lived 100 yards away from the beach. I could go swim in the morning and then go to work. It's nice. It's amazing. Wow. Yeah, it's truly amazing. And so I did that for about 3.5 years. And then our family expanded here in Southwest Florida. The grandchild was born. I'm like, well, okay, we want to go live near the grandchildren. So I came back to the States and took a position at Southwest Florida Veterinary Specialists with the cardiologist there. And that's kind of the Reader's Digest condensed version of how I got here.
I love it.
It was almost as long as the typed version that we have.
Yes, I love it.
I've been around the block more than once. I mean, So this is something people don't realize until I tell them this, okay? If you stop and think about it, I started veterinary medicine in 1976. Parvovirus emerged in 1979 and 80. I am older than parvovirus. I remember seeing parvovirus emerge, which is actually where I cut my teeth on catheter placement and management because I was putting in 20 a day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and when I was teaching, like I would tell some of my students that I was in school before the internet, right. And that blows their mind. But you're probably one of the few people that we've had on where you have a lot more seniority than we do, to phrase it nicely.
That's okay. I understand.
That's awesome. You know, Ed, one thing that you said in there that made me think, when I didn't become licensed as a veterinary technician until 2009, but I started as a veterinary assistant in 95. And when I kind of started looking at how to become licensed, you know, there was a few brick and mortar schools here around Southern California. So it wasn't terribly hard to do, but it certainly wasn't anywhere as prevalent as it is now, or there were no online options. But in California, one of the ways that you could get licensed was if you had a bachelor's degree in a animal type of field. Like if you had a BS in biology or a BS in micro or a BS in animal science or something along those lines, you could just apply to sit. And at the same thing at the time, we had our own kind of cumulative state exam. We didn't use the VTNE still, but it was now looking back on that was only, you know, not even 15 years ago that just by having a bachelor's degree, because again, that technician shortage you mentioned, you could become licensed in California. And it still just like blows my mind that was that was how it was not that long ago.
And that's exactly how I've proceeded through my career. So I actually, when I mentioned I moved to California, and the first thing I did, of course, was how do I get a California license? Because I've chosen this as a profession. I need to do it properly. And by virtue of having a veterinary technician license from another state, I was qualified to take again the same, probably a more comprehensive exam to the one you took. So I think I did mine in 1990, maybe 91. Yeah, I went down that road. So for me, I've taken two comprehensive state exams, but I've never taken the VTNE. So I just make sure I keep those two licenses current all this time. You know, it's an interesting thing, right? Because it's a natural progression for the profession to become more formalized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it is proper and correct for states now to require your graduate of an accredited school. However, what that does for someone like me is it says you can never get another license.
Right, right.
So I'm blocked out because I didn't graduate from an accredited program.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. I know exactly what you're
saying. Preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But it hasn't impacted me negatively. And when I was part of the organizing committee for AIMVT, we actually made it so that was not a requirement, so that people who had been around in the business longer would not be excluded by making a program graduation requirement.
Right, right.
Yeah, and we're starting to do that in ECC as well, where, you know, it used to be the diploma or your license, and now they're saying that the diploma has less, I don't want to say this wrong, but from what I understand, the diploma is going to have less of a value as opposed to the credentials. People like us that are credentialed, we're going to be qualifiers where, you know, years past, if we didn't have that diploma, we wouldn't qualify.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I completely understand that. Yeah. And like I said, it's correct and proper. I see.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I see veterinary technology as a profession being where nursing was, let's say, 75 years ago.
Yep.
Right. Because nurses were originally trained by their doctors to do the things they needed them to do. Much like when I was coming up, you went to work as a assistant and they trained you to become a tech.
Right.
So I think that it, like I say, is correct and proper.
Yeah. And we're kind of in that limbo stage where there are still people that have gone the route that we have, but there's also people that should be going to school and making a career out of this,
right,
as opposed to, because I did the same thing you did. Like, it took me a long time to get my credentials because I was like, I don't know if this is really what I want to do. But then eventually something clicked in my head and I'm like, yeah, this is what I want to do. And now what do I got to do to make this be my career? And I kind of did the same thing you did. Obviously, not quite to the scale that you've progressed through, but did kind of the same route. And just thinking about, you know, everything that you've been through and how you've progressed, you know, back when you said, you know, you were just an assistant and a janitor and kind of worked your way up and got your way through that. And now even working through the VTS process and all that stuff, how do you view the veterinary technician profession right now? Like, what are your thoughts on tech utilization, respect, all those things that we talk about as hot topics for what we look at giving the status of us as a profession? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I honestly and truly believe that it has never been better. Truly, I legitimately believe that if you want to dedicate yourself to, I really see this as a profession, not mm-hmm. just the girl who works in the back anymore.
Yeah.
And I mean, you look at the people who have master's degrees, right? The University of Missouri now has an online master's program, and their neurotech is the first one to go through it. So Stephanie Gilliam got her VTS in neuro, and now she's got her master's degree in veterinary neurology, right, mm-hmm. at the tech level.
Yeah.
So it's never been better from that standpoint. I think that my experience over the 40 years I've been doing this is that, contrary to what you see posted on Facebook a lot, the majority of veterinarians appreciate, understand, and want to utilize their techs. I can look back with the virtue of age and say, you know, 25, 30 years ago, you very much were just another machine in the hospital. And if you failed to perform, they would just boot you out and hire another one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that's as much the case today as it once was. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say what you see, because I'm part of the Not One More Veterinary Tech Facebook page, mm-hmm. and I see people struggling in their jobs. And, you know, I had a confrontation with the doctor today, and I get it. Like, those are bad things. Bad things still happen. But mm-hmm. if I step back and look at the big picture, it has never been a better time in America, I would say in Europe and Canada, to be a vet tech. Like, it mm-hmm. is a blooming career that is only going to go up.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's a really great perspective. And as you were just kind of saying a couple of minutes ago, right, it's good and proper for the forward trajectory here. And it sounds like you're able to look back and see that in that aspect of the profession as well, that we're more respected, that we're a part of the team, not just a machine or a cog in the wheel that is easily replaceable. That's really good to hear.
I do give some credit to that, to the technicians working at the teaching hospitals, because they're training the young veterinarians coming out mm-hmm. to what the skill set a technician has. I used to work with a cardiologist who's now here in Florida, a little bit north of me, and he would tell the students all the time, your technician should be better at drawing blood than you are. That's why you hired them.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a legit statement.
Right.
And so I think that the veterinary technicians in universities get some credit for teaching veterinarians that the technicians are true paraprofessionals.
Yeah.
And, you know, my intern now says that she got super spoiled when she was at Texas A&M because the technicians did so much. They did everything for them. They calculated all the CRIs. And in a way, they were almost too good because it gave them the doctors a bit of a crutch. So they would just say, yeah, set that dog up on a lidocaine CRI and walk away from it.
Right.
And the tech would do it. And it would be done correctly. So I really do think that, you know, technicians get to do more now than we ever did. I think that if you really want to be a hands-on tech, get your VTS in anesthesia. Seriously. I love cardio. Don't get – but the anesthesia techs are the ones who are doing the job that usually a boarded person does. Mm-hmm. Right? They're often coming up with their own protocols, clearing it with a doctor. They are setting catheters. They're doing the inductions. They're getting them hooked up. They're getting them going. Like they're making decisions about blood pressure management on the fly. It's great. I love doing anesthesia when I was at Ross because it gave me so much freedom. You know, once you prove to your doctors that you know what you're doing, they're perfectly happy to let you kind of make your own decisions and do things.
I couldn't agree more. Seeing the VTS anesthesia people did at Tufts. I was blown away that you know, with exactly what you're describing, them doing their own protocols, getting their own medical histories, like the whole nine yards, you know, from pre-op through recovery. It was just fascinating to watch. Yeah.
I think it's great. I mean, not that all the other VTSs don't have their thing, but if I had to say which one do I think they get to do the most hands-on advanced level stuff, it's probably anesthesia. Now, in my job right now, I'm doing amazing high level stuff. Don't get me wrong. I'm doing more than what most cardio VTSs are doing, I would say, because I do about 80 to 90% of the echoes in our clinic. And I acquire all the images, I do all the measurements, I write the report, and then my cardiologist sits down behind me, reviews everything, finalizes the report, and off we go, which is very much the human cardiology model. So I'm kind of working at that level that, you know, most of the VTSs that I know are not getting to do echoes. It's an intern, a resident, or the cardiologist who's doing all of their own echoes. So I'm very fortunate in that aspect that I spend most of my day on the echo machine.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was actually just going to ask kind of to take us through a day. What kind of things do you do as a VTS in cardiology that maybe a non-VTS technician working for a cardiologist may do? Or, you know, what kind of procedures do you assist with? Or, you know, what does your kind of typical day look like? So sounds like you're doing a lot of echocardiograms.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty much why I was hired in this role, is because I brought that skill. And one of the fundamental requirements to get your cardio VTS is that you can acquire the basic images. Mm. Now, unfortunately, because my idea was to develop a model in cardiology where the doctors didn't necessarily do all of their own echoes, but as one cardiologist pointed out to me, it's like, that's kind of where the fun is. Like, okay, I get that. I get it. So, you know, they kind of like to do their own echoes because it's fun. But so every VTS in cardiology knows how to echo. Right. I just have the luxury of being able to practice on 6 to 8 cases every day. Mm. And so I work with two other techs in our service, and then the cardiologist, and the two other techs basically take histories, get our patients in the room, they take radiographs and do the lab work. And I help with those things. But then my primary role is, once they get them in the door, get the history, the doctor's done the exam, we get them down on the table, I do their echo, then they take them off, draw blood, get the radiographs while I'm writing the report, finalizing the paper, and then boom, the next one comes in. That's kind of our standard day. We don't currently do a lot of cardiac cath procedures just because our medicine schedule is so busy. Our doctor is actually booked out to next September.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, we are absolutely inundated, but we are the only cardiologist in our area for probably 200 miles. So that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
We do have a second boarded cardiologist coming, which will open up the schedule a little more for us to do procedures. But when we do get to go to the cath lab, I'm the one that's getting all their stuff out for them. I'm setting up the fluoroscopy C-arm for them. I know their catheters before they need. They even know what they need. When they run into a problem, they're like, Ed, what do you think we should do here? Because I've been doing, I learned cardiac cath lab from Dr. Bonagura, who learned it from Dr. Hamlin and people like that. And so, you know, my depth in the cath lab is kind of unparalleled. When I was at Missouri, some of the new doctors were like, Ed, you've done this way longer than we have. What do you think? And so I can bring them tricks like that. I do all the pacemaker programming because I'm a pacemaker geek. I absolutely love pacemakers. And so, you know, the doctor I work with now, she just stopped doing it. I just tell her what I've done. And she's like, okay, great. That sounds fantastic. Because I've done so many, you know, the dual chamber pacing is such a mind puzzle, trying to synchronize atrial and ventricular activity and, you know, get the timing just so, and working out the problems. Why is it not pacing correctly? And so I do all of that pacemaker programming. I make sure that if we have to do emergency pacemakers, I'm already, you know, help with the temporary pacing catheters. I have a pretty high level role in our clinic because I'm the only cardio VTS around.
Gotcha.
So I actually like that. But primarily what I do is I do echoes and write reports for them. And then, you know, our clinic is suffering from a lack of staff. This is a area, our Southwest Florida area has a real shortage of qualified technicians. Every clinic in this area is desperate to hire more people.
Yeah.
And so I will often end up filling in the ICU. Thursday, I spent an hour and a half managing an Addisonian crisis dog, not in my house. Really needed a lot of help with that. Seriously, lots of But that's what I ended up doing because I bring a lot of experience to the clinic that there's really only one other tech who does all the anesthesia for our surgeon has. So.
Gotcha. And for some of our listeners out there that may be like newer to the field, can you just kind of describe or define what you mean by cardiac cath lab?
Some people may not know
what we're talking about there.
So in veterinary cardiology, we do intracardiac catheterization. So if you think about grandma had a coronary artery bypass, well, the first thing they did was they imaged her coronary arteries. Fortunately for us in veterinary medicine, coronary artery disease doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So what we do are there's really three big procedures that get done in cardiology. One is closing of patent ductus arteriosus through a catheter. So we don't have to open the chest to do that. We can actually put a little plug-like device called the Amplatz canine ductal occluder into the patent ductus arteriosus from inside the body. It's like we do it right up the aorta. We drop this little thing in there and it basically just plugs the thing up and it's curative. The other thing we do is, when I say we, I mean all veterinary cardiology, is we do balloon valvuloplasty for pulmonic stenosis. So some dogs, particularly small breed dogs, boxers, bulldogs, will get a narrowing of the pulmonic valve as it leaves the right ventricle. And in some of those cases, what you can do is you put a catheter with a long balloon on it across that valve. It sort of straddle the valve area. When you inflate that balloon, it stretches out those leaflets and gets them to open up more fully, and we can reduce the amount of stricture created by the stenosis. So PDA closure, pulmonic stenosis, balloon valvuloplasty, and then the other one is the pacemaker implantation. So those are the big three.
Wow. Okay. Those sound super nerdy and super exciting to, like, just hearing about it. I'm like, I want to come watch that. Like that sounds really fascinating. It's just something that cardiology is kind of like a side thing for me, where I love ECGs. I love looking at echoes, but, you know, I've never really gone to the level that you're at, obviously, but that's something that's super fascinating to me, that you guys get to do all that stuff. I've only seen, I want to say maybe 2-3 dogs in my career that have actually had a pacemaker. So it's fantastic that you guys get to do all that stuff.
Yeah, the pacemaker was actually my first independent publication that I wrote all of my own, was for the back when the Vet Tech Journal was a print journal.
Yeah.
God, it sounds so long ago. Was on pacemakers, because we were putting a lot in and I wanted the technicians in private practice to know what we were doing, how it was done, and what their role was when that patient came back to their clinic. And I still pass that out to people when they're like, I want to know more. I gave it to so many students.
You'll have to send that to us so we can share that.
Yeah.
Sure.
That'd be great.
And then just thinking about the VTS process of becoming a VTS in cardiology, I'm still amazed that there's only 20 or 22 of you. That's just amazing. I for some reason, I thought there would be a lot more of you. But thinking about the process going through that, like what types of skills? I know you mentioned echoes, cardiac catheterization, all that stuff is on there, pacemaker technology. Is there something else on there that you know, we probably don't think about that you guys need to know? I'm guessing ECGs are on there, probably knowledge of all the cardiac drugs. What else is involved in that process?
So more of the fundamental skills, right? So we've hit all the big skills. So the fundamental skills of being able to hear and accurately describe heart sounds.
Okay.
Right? A lot of people underestimate, and this is my soapbox, so please forgive me.
Yeah, go for it.
I really feel like the art of the physical exam is dying. And in cardiology particularly, it is a incredibly useful skill. The reality is with a good history and a physical exam, I can get about 95% of the way to the correct diagnosis. It's just a matter of confirming it and assigning severity that I need the other diagnostics for. Case management, like, okay, how are the kidneys doing now that we've put this dog on all these diuretics? That's really what those things are for. But as far as arriving at the correct diagnosis, cardiology in particular really lends itself well to that. And I see a lot of cases referred where the veterinarians kind of abdicated the authority over their own case because, oh, I hear a murmur, I don't know what to do. They throw their hands up and they refer it. Do that. You know, you learn this stuff in school. So it's those kind of things. I do want to comment because people might be listening to this and they might say, oh my gosh, you know, we don't have a cath lab. Like, it's fine. So when I put this together, and I'm going to take credit for this one, I will say, when I put this together, I thought, okay, universities are the places doing most of the cath procedures. I don't want to eliminate the private practice technician from being able to do this because of the cardiac catheterization requirement. So what we did is we have a skills list and we have a knowledge list, which is, I think, is different than a lot of other
things. Yeah, that's different.
Yeah,
we have the skills list, but not the knowledge list.
We have a knowledge list. And what that does is it allows me to say, if I show you a cardiac catheter, you need to be able to tell me what it is and what it's for. But you may not have ever had to use one. So there are things that you need to have as knowledge, but you don't necessarily have to have experience with. Stuff you can get from a book and in conversation. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because we didn't want to eliminate people who worked in a place like I am now where they rarely do cath procedures.
Yeah.
We didn't want this to become a university tech exclusive organization.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That's a really good model. That's cool.
Yeah. And so we built, part of this came from discussions with the organizing committee at large. And we realized that as internal medicine technicians, the actual skills we didn't have the skill set that you need for emergency critical care. Like rarely do we do central lines. Rarely do we set art lines. You know, we're not doing things like that very often. So we didn't have a lot of advanced skills per se, but what we realized is that it's the advanced knowledge. It's how to deal with transfusion reactions, how to deal with these Addison crisis dogs, how to deal with the internal medicine portion of the diabetic dog, how to deal with the heart failures, right? Because it's all brain stuff. It's not really tech stuff. If you look at the menu of things that cardiologists do, blood pressures, radiographs, echoes, lab work, ECG. That's kind of from a skill set. That's kind of what we do. It's what to do with those things that are important. So, yes, you have to be able to run an ECG as a cardiotech. More importantly, you have to be able to identify major arrhythmias. So it's a knowledge thing, not a skill thing.
Right.
I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, is that some of those things that you guys do is knowledge-based, not necessarily skill-based.
Right. So our knowledge list is actually longer than our skills list.
Right.
Now,
right.
On the skills list, there is a requirement for doing a basic right-sided echocardiogram. We thought that was important, that they should have that skills. Although I'm no longer director at large for the cardiology, the young lady who took my place, Christy Garcia, we have talked extensively about adding a Doppler evaluation as part of the skills list, which would raise the bar just a little bit for people. Because Doppler is another level of knowledge that is not necessarily intuitive, because it requires that you know normal chamber pressures in the heart and you know something about the physics of blood flow. I always tell people that the echo gives you information about the structure, size, shape, and systolic function of the heart. Doppler gives you information about the hemodynamics and diastolic function of the heart. So they're separate. Ooh. You do them at the same time, but they give you a completely separate database.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. Wow.
Hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, no kidding. So, Ed, looking at where you're at now, especially because you've kind of described about, you know, not wanting to leave out the private practice cardiology technicians, kind of where you find yourself now, taking your wealth of knowledge and experience into that kind of role. How does your advanced credential of being a VTS in cardiology, you know, impact your cardiology service at that hospital and those clients and those patients? What have you been able to bring to the table as a VTS in cardiology that maybe they weren't getting before?
I would say the number one thing is my ability to teach. So,
okay,
to be perfectly honest with you, this is not my ideal job. I love what I do. Don't get me wrong. My ideal job is teaching. I was in my element at Ross, where I had three tables and I was working with students teaching. That's when I lose myself, is when I start teaching. Like right now, you know, I feel like I'm getting to share information with somebody else. And I see we've already sucked up 50 minutes. And I'm like, don't let it stop. Like, this is great. So I think that's what I bring, is that teaching thing, that I've elevated the skill set of all the technicians that I work with. Because we also have a lot of assistants who are working under the title of technician. We have a few credentialed technicians. I'm the only VTS in the clinic. And so I've become a leader from that standpoint, by virtue of age and credentialing, but also that I love to teach. And I'm, you know, bringing these young kids up that want to know more. And the doctors often don't have time to do it because we're so busy.
Right.
And so I've brought that. I've also brought a sense of comfort to the clients when I can go out and they're having a problem, and I'll go out to the parking lot. We're doing the same COVID thing as everybody else still. I'll go out to the parking lot and meet with them face to face and give them my card and say, look, I'm boarded as a cardiology nurse for your pet. Like, you call me if you have any questions. And they get such a sense of comfort, if for no other reason than they feel like there's someone they can talk to that has been down this road. You know, I've been doing cardiology alone for over 20 years now. And I think that those are the two things. And then, of course, from a, you know, purely business standpoint, I've improved the efficiency of the service because I can echo while the cardiologist is doing something else.
Mm-hmm. Before we get going, one thing I want to ask you is how have you survived so long in this field where, you know, we've talked about this on the show before, that the lifespan of a technician nowadays is about 5 to 7 years, and you've lasted probably twice as long as most of our listeners are actually old.
Probably.
How have you survived? You know, you've gone through many different career paths. How have you made it so long and maintained that motivation and that that drive to keep going?
Yeah, and avoided some of those pitfalls.
Yeah, exactly.
Burnout and compassion fatigue that some of our colleagues have faced.
So I would say the number one thing I've done, and I don't mean to be flip about this, but in all seriousness, is I've not taken myself too seriously.
Okay.
I know that sounds kind of like, well, what does that mean? What I mean by that is, at the end of the day, it's the doctor's decision to do things. It's the doctor's responsibility. You know, I'm pretty well protected as the technician from all legal ramifications, for the most part. And so I've learned not to take myself too seriously and be like, well, I've been doing this longer than, you know, you've been a doctor. I don't do that. I don't do that at all. And to keep myself interested, is I've changed my thing. I'm constantly putting a challenge in front of me. So I mentioned in California, I went into general practice. I kind of glossed over that. Well, what I did when I was there is I absorbed myself in dentistry. And I did dentistry all day long for about a year. And it was great. I got to do my own protocols because, again, licensed in California as a credentialed tech, you have a lot of latitude. You can do a lot of things. And so I immersed myself in dentistry. I went to dentistry courses, became really great at it. Then when I moved to Missouri, I found a new thing of osteoporosis research. Like, okay, a whole new field I didn't know anything about. I had a chance to go back into cardiology, which I already knew I loved. And actually, it's a funny story. My stepfather was one of the people that got me into cardiology. And he was an extraordinarily confident veterinarian, and rightfully so. He was extremely skilled. I rarely heard him sound like he didn't know what to do with a case. Mm. And I talked to him when I was at Missouri, and he said, you know, I hear John Bonagura is at Missouri. I'm like, yeah, he is. He's doing the cardiologist. And he said, he's my hero. If you could go to work for him, you should. I was floored. Like, I'm actually getting a little teared up telling the story because my stepfather never admitted anybody was better than him. And for him to say, this guy is my hero, like, okay, I need, and sure enough, he was right. Dr. Bonagura is amazing. So I threw myself into that new, here's something I love, which is cardiology. And there's a new mystery to it. There's echo, there's ECG, there's all this stuff I wanted to know about. And now I'm sitting every day clinic with the guru.
Yeah.
It doesn't get better than that. I'm sorry. It just doesn't. I can't tell you how many cardiologists I know that say, oh, man, we would have loved to work with Dr. Bonagura. Like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Because he's that good. And he's super cool about it too. He's really mellow. That's the best part, is he's just a super nice guy to work with. Nice. So I would say the short answer to your question is, keep a new challenge in front of you, right? Don't rest on your laurels. Use them as a springboard. I have this saying that I use, which is, a really good group of technicians is like a team of Navy SEALs. So if you listen to the Navy SEALs, they will tell you that Navy SEALs are good at three, possibly four things. And they're good at shooting, moving, communicating. And the fourth one is they're experts at becoming experts. So, okay, how does that translate to veterinary medicine? Okay, well, Navy SEALs, their job is to shoot. Okay, well, my job is highly advanced technical skills. So I want to do my technical skills really, really well, constantly. Like, how do I improve my knowledge base in this, my skill set in this, right? Advance your technical skills by doing things you've never done before. They move. What they mean is that they can clear a room efficiently without shooting each other with live rounds, okay? So as technicians, you do your technical skills extremely efficiently so that you save time and trauma on your patients. I remember an anesthesiologist at a conference saying, time is trauma. And that's, I've taken that beyond the realm of anesthesia into everything I do. So I exercise my technical skills. I exercise my technical skills effectively and then communicate. Like, that's pretty obvious, right? Their SEALs don't want to shoot each other, so they have to know where each other is. They communicate really well. So I execute my skills efficiently, and I make sure everyone on my team knows what I'm doing, when I'm doing it, and what's been done, so they don't waste time and energy and efficiency repeating stuff that's been done. The joke between me and the other two techs I work with is over-communicate. Like, we're constantly like, yeah, got it, I'm on that. Right? And it saves us a lot of time, and that's really important for us. And then the last thing is experts are becoming experts. I learned from Dr. Bonagura that if you want to be better, you need to read still. And the way to do it the most effectively is read about what you saw during the day. Even if you just spend 15, 20, 30 minutes a night, you saw an Addisonian case, you don't understand everything that happened, but now you've seen it. You go home and read about Addisonians. Next time you see one, you will remember what you read because it's associated with case, and you'll become a better technician.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So execute efficiently, communicate, study.
I would say I did that. I did that when I was studying for boards, but now that I'm beyond the study stage, I don't do that anymore, which is probably something I probably need to get back into. Of like you said, an Addisonian case. When I was studying for boards, I would go home and I would read every book that I had that had a section on Addisonian and became an expert in that. And now that I see them, I kind of just rely on the knowledge that I have and I don't read up on it again, which again is something that I probably need to be doing more of.
Well, I think for me, it's because I'm such a science geek. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I want to be a vet tech because I love dogs and cats. Great. Totally love that. I'm not that guy. I want to be a vet tech because I love the science. The science is so fascinating to me. And so I will come home and I will read about what I saw during the day. It's like, oh, we got this really cool case. Let me go home and read about that a little bit more. Mm. Or I like old books because they remind me of the things that we could be doing. So like one of my favorite books is called Physiology and Biophysics of Circulation by Alan C. Burton. And this was published in, I'm not even sure it's got a publishing date. It's so old. Oh, this version is 1975. Hmm. Oh, 72. Sorry. And I go back and I read this stuff and I'm like, oh yes, there's a foundation principle that I can still use today. So that would be my advice for techs. And again, take your job seriously, take your career seriously, but give yourself a little bit of a break. Don't take everything that happens in the clinic as a personal insult. You know, like I said earlier, I really like the I hate to call it self-improvement because that implies there's something wrong with you. But the idea of being a better version of myself all the time. And so I listen to a lot of different people on YouTube and some podcasts, and without doing a bunch of name dropping, one person said, if you are offended, one of two things has occurred. Either the person has actually done something to offend you, or you're just being too sensitive.
It is. It's true. It's one of those two things.
True. And so I have had to learn to check myself and like, okay, did this person really want to offend me and hurt my feelings, or are they stressed and just feeling something and I'm being overly sensitive? Most of the time I find that I'm being overly sensitive. Nice. And I can shake that off and get on, because I don't let a bad moment turn into a bad day.
Right. Right.
You can't do that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, Ed, as we're approaching our hour, we'll start to wrap up here. I just want to ask, is there anything you want to get out to our listeners about becoming a VTS in cardiology or working in the cardiology field? Anything along those lines that we haven't touched on today that you want to put out there that you want to talk about that we didn't ask about?
I think I'm going to expand it beyond just cardiology VTS to all VTSs.
Okay.
So what I've learned from accomplishing my VTS, and I am extremely proud of the VTS cardio program. I'm extremely proud of the people. I'm extremely proud of the fact that I got to be the very first one. But what I've learned from this is that, and I don't think you have to have a VTS to have this happen as a technician. You just have to prove yourself competent. Right? We live in a competence-based hierarchy. If you are competent as a veterinary technician, and that means in your knowledge and your skills, and your doctors can rely on you as an extension of themselves, you become part of their team. And that teamwork is what makes your job fulfilling and rewarding as you take up the responsibility of patient care, because you're part of a group. Everybody wants to belong. And I think that when I read posts by technicians who are frustrated and they want to quit their job, that they pick the wrong career, almost all of it can be boiled down to they don't feel like they're part of a team. And I'm never going to say that the doctor didn't make me feel like I wasn't part of the team. I'm going to say, what did I not do that made them have confidence in me that left me out of their team? And how can I fix that to become a better team member? So I think that if you get your VTS, it says you really are sincere and you want to be competent, and the doctors are more inclined to make you part of their team, where you become a colleague, not just an employee. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you demonstrate competence to your doctors, they will see you as a paraprofessional and as a colleague. And when things get tough in the clinic, if you can shake off those emotions and show emotional resilience with your competence, even better. Because this is a grown-up field with life or death decisions and grown-up work. And if you're feeling that everyone in the clinic hates you, well, then maybe you need to turn your spectacles inward and say, what am I doing? Am I meeting my full potential? Am I doing everything I need to be doing? Am I going the extra mile to understand what everyone else is going through? Because everybody has stress. Everybody has a bad day.
Yeah.
And you can't take someone else's bad day as your problem.
Hmm. Yeah, it's true.
Because it's probably not directed at you. They just needed to vent.
Yeah. We do need to do that a lot in this field.
Yes.
Yeah. We absolutely do. The other thing I would say is, okay, I'm old. Like, if I have time to throw this last
yeah,
thing in.
Yeah, of course.
Is you got to train. I'm sorry. You got to go to the gym. You got to run. You got to ride your bike. This is a game for young people who are flexible and strong. I had a 80-kilogram Great Dane as our last case on Thursday night. I'm almost 60, but I can still get all the way down, squat that dog, and pick him up. Ooh, yeah, boy. I had help, but yeah. you still got to do it, right? And so I would say that if people overlook this, I think, in veterinary medicine, is if you want to have a long career in veterinary medicine, you've got to stay in physical shape. And, yeah. And the science is actually really clear that a physical training program keeps your brain sharp, too, because you increase blood flow and oxygen and glucose to your brain, and your brain stays sharp. It is the one thing that we know for sure will keep your mental capacity strong.
Excellent.
I think I'm gonna have to go for a bike ride later.
Well, I've already said I'm going for a run right after this, so that
yep
now I've got a reason.
Awesome.
Well, Ed, we're just about out of time tonight or today, and we have one last question for you. This is the Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question. Are you ready for it?
Absolutely.
All right. Would you rather have skin that changes based on your emotions or have tattoos appear in your body depicting what you did yesterday?
Oh. I think I would rather have tattoos that appear on my body depicting what I did yesterday.
And why is that?
It would probably be more interesting to people around me.
Yeah. I mean, if a tattoo just randomly showed up of you doing an echocardiogram on a dog, like, yeah. What a great conversation starter.
Yeah, because, you know...
You don't already have that tattoo, do you?
No, I don't. Actually, I'm a real rebel. I am tattoo and piercing free.
Yeah, same here.
Same.
I'm a bold rebel against conventions.
That's awesome.
I don't think I would like to have my skin change colors based on my emotions.
I have a would you rather question for you guys.
This is our second would you rather question. We got one in the last episode too.
This is awesome.
Okay. Would you rather have opposable thumbs on your feet or a prehensile tail?
Oh. Ooh. Opposable thumbs.
I have my answer.
I don't know what I would want.
I would say, like, I guess it really depends on the length, but a prehensile tail that I could just kind of like lean back and like rest myself against that sounds kind of nice.
I don't know. Opposable thumbs on my feet. That I would have to buy all new shoes, so I'm gonna have to go with the tail as well.
Right, because you can always just cut a hole in your pants.
My running shoes are kind of expensive, and I don't want to cut them up.
Right.
Excellent.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for your time today and talking to us about all of the cool things that you've done, and honestly, the VTS and cardiology. We're trying to get some information out there about all of the VTSs and everything that you can do and what it takes to get there to kind of let technicians know that some of these avenues are out there. So thank you so much for taking your time and coming by and talking to us about that. We really, really appreciate it and really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah,
it was my pleasure.
Well, everybody, enjoy the rest of your weekend. Caffeinators, we hope you guys are well, and we'll look forward to seeing you the next time at the Vet Tech Cafe. Bye, guys. Hey, caffeinators. We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As you guys are well aware by now, we often talk about difficult issues that face our profession, and we chat with colleagues and leaders in our field who have strong opinions of these issues. Those opinions expressed by either Dave and I as the hosts or those opinions expressed by our guests are their opinions alone and do not represent any other person, any other business or institution or any other entity with or within the scope of veterinary medicine. If you have any questions relating to this, please feel free to email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. You can check out our website, vettechcafe.com. And please, whatever podcast form you're using to listen to our episodes, like us, follow us there, like us and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And lastly, have a great day, caffeinators. You guys are awesome. Bye, guys.